A lively discussion, and I think probably an excellent segue to the next item, which is we have a number of trustees with us today. Welcome to you all. It's great to see you, and I'll turn it over to Michelle.
Thank you, Chairman. It's good to be here. Hello to everybody. I will try to summarize briefly where we are since we met last in Johannesburg in July. As you know, we will meet again tomorrow and the day after in Frankfurt. I will leave it to Scott and Bob to comment on the due process, nominating, and possibly the U.S. Issues. We have extensively talked about Japan. I will just say a few words on that. Let me address a few of the questions that we have considered lately. The first set of issues deals with funding, which is an important and difficult issue for us today. It is challenging because we've not yet found a totally stable system that would function regularly without any difficulty in a seamless way. Therefore, we have a series of initiatives to improve the situation. Firstly, we are trying to design a system that would be fully understood and accepted once and for a long time at least to determine the way the funding should be organized and balanced. The main idea within this system is to make clear that we are seeking a balance where a significant proportion of the funding, if not all the funding, would come from publicly sponsored contributions, which requires two efforts. One is to find the proper criteria, and we have made clear that we considered today that the criteria should be related to GDP. And second, the difficulty is to find a way whereby all countries that have adopted or permitted or involved in IFRS contribute effectively. We still are worried by the fact that a number of countries either do not contribute at all or do not contribute in proportion to the criteria we are trying to make accepted by everybody. Therefore, we are seeking support from a number of organizations to help us in this undertaking. From the global perspective, we will be in touch with the Monitoring Board and with the Financial Stability Board and other organizations to make sure that the philosophy we are defending is widely supported and accepted, and that members of these organizations help us in our bilateral relationship with countries that should support us. The second item there is revisiting the relationship we have with firms, and we're trying to determine a system whereby firms would contribute in a wider way, both the big ones but also the second and three and third tier firms that for some of them do contribute today but others don't, and we would like to see this contribution widened so that, by the way, this would enhance the neutrality of the system. And finally, we are looking into the intellectual property issue, which is an extremely complex one. because this is a non-for-profit organization. This is an organization that delivers standards for the public good, and trying to combine this fundamental essence of the organization with an intellectual property system whereby we would ask people who use some of our production for commercial purposes do contribute to our funding in a proper way. And this is not an easy one, and we will have a discussion on this in Frankfurt in the couple of days to come. The second item I would like to address is international strategy. In a way, we've started talking about it with the presentation of the Japanese situation and a few comments on the U.S. I have the feeling that we have to contemplate a sort of new situation in a way, which is the fact that the last 12 years or so have seen a remarkable development of IFRS around the globe. Continuous support by the G20 to the final objective of a single set of high-quality accounting standards. At the same time, the crisis has created some sort of destabilization of the dynamism of this process, and we've seen the U.S. Hesitating to move forward. We see initiatives here and there where people consider that they might slow the process or find a different way forward. And therefore, the true question for us, I think, is to make sure that we don't go the wrong direction and that we manage properly a new dynamic towards the adoption of international standards. Convergence between the ISB and the FASB is coming to an end. It has been driving a lot of effort for a number of years and quite successfully in many cases. People tend to forget this, but a lot of convergence has taken place, but we know that today the rule of the game has changed, and today we are considering a global policy, namely through ASAF. The G20 has focused on a series of messages in the past, not only a single set of accounting standards, but convergence has repeatedly mentioned in the communiques, and therefore we come to a time where probably there need to be some kind of new approach to these issues at the international level. I am optimistic, clearly, but I'm also realistic. There are difficulties ahead of us, and we have to find the proper way to consolidate the policy that was adopted 12 years ago and supported since then unanimously. So we will work on this. It is an issue which deals with substance, which is clearly in the hands of the board, but also with diplomacy, which the trustees try to get involved in a proper way. And I would urge that we do not see, as in some fields, in other areas of financial issues, a tendency to renationalize or to move away from the dynamism that led to a situation where the world has become more global, more integrated, and where capital flows were made easier and markets were integrated. We can see in a number of cases questions about some sort of renationalization or some sort of specific approach at the national or at the regional level. I think this would be extremely detrimental to the future of the financial system globally, and therefore I believe that we must make our best efforts to manage the transition. Transition is needed, and we have to deal with it. This is a pragmatic approach, but to avoid any decision that might be detrimental to the movement that was triggered a number of years ago. I will not comment on the specific issues with regard to US and Japan. Bob will say a few words on the US. The only thing I would like to mention is that I have been visiting the SEC in July, and I had an extremely interesting and encouraging meeting with Mary Jo White, but I know that since then the trustees have had other contacts with our U.S. colleagues, and I'm very optimistic that we will find a way forward. And we will work in this direction and avoid any negative impact of the situation in the U.S. on the rest of the world. With regard to Japan, I have no comment to make now. Everything has been said. Only to mention that I also will visit our Japanese colleagues in November, and I hope that we will determine a way forward which is a positive way forward. Together with Hans, I'm ready to visit Japan as often as possible, because I love Japan and because I hope this will facilitate the achievement we have in common. Let me just say a word on Europe, which oddly enough has also come to the forefront in recent months, for different reasons, by the way, and the kind of a combination of phenomena that created a new atmosphere there. There are basically two questions in Europe. One is a European issue, although it is of great interest for us because it will determine the way the IASB and the IFRS Foundation will develop the very close and fruitful cooperation we have with Europe. And this is the internal organization of Europe. And as you know, we are waiting for the publication of the Maystadt report. I have to say that we have met with Mr. Maystadt several times. We've exchanged views. We've expressed our ideas. Clearly, the IFRS Foundation should not step into the internal discussions of the EU, but it can provide some views with regard to the way our cooperation, our exchange of views are facilitated. Françoise could elaborate on this better than me, together with Hans. What we wish really is to see a system whereby the working relationship between the IASB and the European counterpart remains a fruitful technical cooperation, and where we avoid to see this kind of trend here and there we might be worried to see developing worldwide. I do believe that on this item there are quite different sets of issues. Internal management of the EU, and it's not our business, sort of philosophical divides that sometimes, to my view, are not necessarily well-founded, and where debating on highly philosophical items is indeed a way to make things more complex, whereas when you look at the technicalities, in fact, when you land and you look into the practicalities, there are less difficulties than envisaged. And then work together to deliver the best output. Obviously, Europe is extremely important to the IFRS Foundation and plays, by the way, a major role within the organization today. The second question we have with regard to Europe is the issue of funding. And it's part of the global question. It is also an issue which has some origins in the internal questions of Europe itself. Like all public organizations today, Europe is confronted with funding issues globally, and they have budgetary policies, budgetary constraints, and so on and so forth, and we have to deal with this. But I wouldn't like to see, on that occasion, our organization sort of in a position to see its fundamental nature questioned by the system. And we have been in touch with the ECOFIN, we have been in touch with the Commission, with the EU Parliament, to talk about this very, very frankly and to explain what we can understand and what we would not like to see developing with regard to the independence of this organization and the risk that if this organization would be in a position to see its independent impaired, then other countries or other regions might have the same approach to these issues. And these messages have been clearly made to our counterparts. Having said that, I will stop here. We'll come back later to a final item, but I would like to to leave the floor. No, there's one point I would like to mention, which is our relationship with IOSCO, which is part of this international strategy. As you may have seen, we have finalized a protocol with IOSCO, and we believe this is extremely important. IOSCO was at the very inception of the whole process that took place since the early 2000. It appears that today the issues of implementation, enforcement, feedback become even more important than in the past. And clearly securities regulators are best placed to play a critical role in that domain. Hence, the need for us to strengthen the cooperation, to organize the cooperation in a more proactive way. And that was the reason why we signed this protocol with the IOSCO board. And I very much hope that this will deliver in the future. I have to say that this is not exclusive of any other kind of relationship with other bodies. I'm thinking of ESMA, for instance, where we have ESMA has a specific organization to look into the implementation of IFRS within the EU, and obviously we would like to develop our relationship with them. But I guess that this protocol with IOSCO is both politically symbolic and technically most important. Having said that, I will move to Scott for the DPOC, and then to Bob, with your permission, Chair, with regard to the nominating committee and the U.S.
Thank you, Michelle. It's a pleasure for me to be here to meet with the Advisory Council and report on the Due Process Oversight Committee. As you know, the Due Process Oversight Committee of the Trustees overhauled the due process procedures that we asked the ISB to go through in 2012. This is an extensive change, and we've spent 2013 operationalizing those new due process procedures, and we've been operationalizing them at a time when the ISB is extraordinarily busy with new standards. Now, luckily, this has been a process over several years. The practice was already pretty consistent by the end of 2012 with the new procedures, and it's gone remarkably smoothly as we've gone from discussion paper through exposure drafts to finalized standards across the board. When we met in South Africa a couple months ago, we went through a full life cycle review of the revenue recognition project, and talk about extensive due diligence. I mean, this was really an impressive show of due diligence as the staff went through all the consultations that they'd done, all the steps that had been taken, to make sure that they had broadly and fully and fairly consulted with all interest groups on this very important standard of revenue recognition, and that they had done so in a transparent and open manner. The committee was very satisfied that this this had all been done consistently with the standards. The standard is near finalization, but as Hans mentioned, there are a few last minute changes to the document, and they're very, very close here. The other thing we did, in addition to going through the entire technical agenda, it was our annual review of consultative groups. Now, this body, the Advisory Council, is the largest and most important consultative group that we have. And the reason you see so many trustees here, and that you'll always see members of the Due Process Oversight Committee here from time to time, is that it's extraordinarily important that this body function effectively, that we have a good and vigorous debate about issues that are important to preparers and users and standard setters around the world, and that we get everyone's perspective in a vigorous and very well-documented fashion. But we also want to make sure that our smaller consultative groups, the working groups on individual standards, work well. And so we annually review them to make sure that we have broad representation, to make sure that that broad representation is showing up for the meetings, that the meetings are lively, and that the exchanges of views are taking place. So we were a little horrified when we realized that several of the working groups, and these are particular standard working groups, hadn't met in over a year. And so there was much flurry and lots of questions from my colleagues about this. And we were very satisfied with the answer, which, when you think about it, the way that these single-issue working groups work is that there are a lot of meetings. There's a lot of public discussion at the beginning on these issues. And as you go from discussion paper towards exposure draft, the need for these working groups to have formal meetings is reduced, but the need to have individual contacts with the members of the groups is still very strong. So there is still a lot of individual discussions with members of the committees, but they weren't working. So we were satisfied with that, but we're ever alert to make sure that the groups are functioning. So we will always be ready for your input on how this group is working, and particularly on any matters where you think that the due process that's taking place is not up to our standards and not best in class. We really do want to be best in class around the world in terms of due process, and we invite you to help us do that. Just quickly, we're planning in our meetings in Frankfurt later this week. We're going to talk about education material. Education material is important and tricky. It doesn't go through the full due process that a new standard does. And so it's very important that this education material not become authoritative, that everything that's authoritative go through the full due process of a standard. So the staff has prepared some discussions on this, and, you know, we in the Due Process Committee will be very listening very carefully to make sure that we're satisfied that they've come up with a strategy to do this, because it is very important that you have high-quality education material. We'll also meet with or hear a report on the effects analysis consultative group. You know, this is something that we've said has to happen. There's a special group that's been formed. They have some recommendations, or they're in the process of getting some recommendations, and I expect a lively debate on that one. And finally, and Alan mentioned it, there's a proposal to restructure the way that the XBRL organization and advisory council's function. I think this is a very productive direction. We've been discussing it for the last couple of meetings, and we will hear a formal presentation of the new consultative group at the meeting. Why don't I stop there, and when we get to questions, I'm happy to entertain any that you might have.
Thanks, Scott. Bob?
Thank you, Chairman. Let me start with the nominating committee. Actually, we have here in the room Antonio Aki, Scott, also members of the nominating committee, so you've got a quite full representation. And given Scott's comments on the importance of this group, it's quite fitting that the major event occupying us in this coming meeting in Frankfurt later this week is the Advisory Council. We're interviewing for a chair to replace Paul. This is a most difficult task to think of replacing Paul. We also have nine members of this group who complete their terms at the end of this year, of which only one is eligible for reappointment. So we are engaged in determining appointments to fill these slots. We've had a number of nominations. We've had five from Asia Oceania, four from Africa, 16 from Europe, including one from Russia, one from Turkey, 17 from North America, four from South America, two from India, and three from the Middle East. So we have a very rich group of candidates, which is most encouraging. I will tell you that this task is greater than the task the nominating committee has faced before in its deliberations in terms of the numbers. We are thinking of petitioning the chairman for a alteration in our stipend to cover the burden, although this may not be the best time to make that petition. But to deal with that, the issue of the number, we are engaged in a process where the terms of the new appointees will be staggered in length so that we don't have the kind of grouping and bunching that we have had this year and a more even flow of new appointments to this body. In addition to that, we are in the final stages of the process of selecting trustees to replace Jeff Lucey and Pedro Milan, whose terms as trustees come to an end this year. For next year, we have a number of trustees whose terms end, seven end, including the chairman's, but fortunately, they are available and eligible for reappointment. We do have, however, four other trustees whose terms come to an end, and they are not eligible for reappointment, and we will be engaging in that, by the way, including three of the people, of the trustees in this room, including me. At the board level, in mid-2014, we have two board members who reach the end of term. One is eligible for reappointment, and one is not. So that is the nominating committee's agenda for this next meeting, this meeting later this week, and also for the coming meetings going into 2014. And if, with your permission, Chairman, I would then just go on to make some brief comments on the U.S., and I do this, of course, in the context of what Michelle has already said, and essentially reporting on behalf of the U.S. trustees who met with the new SEC chair, Mary Jo White, back in August, right after Michelle had met with her. And I think Hans has actually had a meeting with her subsequently. I think it's important, as Michelle has said, to emphasize that much of the process of convergence with the FASB, which is now coming to its end, has been very successful, and that the relationship in terms of standards with the U.S. has had a number of marked successes. Obviously, there are places where we are still working to try and converge, and Hans talked about those earlier. That is really the context in which we have taken up discussions with Mary Jo White at the SEC, and essentially there are two issues. One is the issue of adoption, the other is the issue of funding from the U.S. Let me talk just briefly about adoption. I think it is our view among the trustees, and certainly the U.S. trustees, that the ideal structure is a statement from the SEC of a full timetable for adoption. The timetable would probably have large filers adopting in 2018, 2019, and some notion of the smaller filers doing it some years after that so that they could have the benefit of the experiences of the large ones. That the mechanism that has been discussed in the U.S. For most of the time now has been a mechanism of endorsement and incorporation, where the standards as set down by the IASB would be incorporated, endorsed into the U.S. standards, and that the FASB would play the role of that incorporator. I think it has always been said that as the FASB plays that role, the expectation would be that there would be a very high standard for non-adoption. The fact is, in the U.S., the SEC has the right not to adopt FASB standards as they are evidenced, and has never chosen to avail itself of that right. And that finally, there was discussion in this context of this ideal structure of some form of early voluntary adoption, the same way that Canada permitted after it set down its rules. That is one avenue of discussion we've had. We have had a second avenue, which I would characterize as a fallback, and that is a pioneer early adoption alternative. That is to take a positive step, very similar to the one that Japan and the one you've been discussing earlier today, of permitting certain firms that meet pre-qualifying conditions to voluntarily adopt IFRS. Probably those conditions would be something about the fact that they are in industries where their worldwide competitors use IFRS, probably that firms use IFRS abroad to a considerable extent so they have experience. And as part of those discussions, an expectation that there would be no danger that firms voluntarily adopting would have to return to GAAP, and no extended reconciliation requirements with GAAP. There are clearly important benefits to this. To investors, $7 trillion of foreign debt and equity are held by U.S. investors, and most of those foreign companies report in IFRS. So this is an aid to investors. There are presently 450 foreign private issuers who use IFRS in the U.S. Without modification. Their market cap is $5.7 trillion. It suggests that investors would be benefited from more of them using IFRS. Firms, I think, the obvious benefits are lower cost of capital, making cross-border merger and acquisition easier, and probably reducing, clearly, their accounting costs. The SEC has at times raised some concern, a risk of this. It's usually characterized as promoting two alternative gaps. I think an answer to that is with already 450 foreign private issuers using IFRS, and that number now increasing with the Canadian firms, that there really already is multiple use of standards, and that this isn't going to make a great deal of difference against that current experience and moves the ball forward in a productive direction. That is adoption. On funding, there is a significant shortfall in the U.S. Of funding if you use as the standard the one Michelle set down earlier of GDP. We receive under $2 million right now from the U.S., and that is not only a small number, but we receive it not through government-sanctioned contributions, which, as Michelle said, is the standard that, looking forward, we believe is the right one. There is a problem for the SEC in the U.S. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which creates a fund from an accounting fee, does not permit the SEC to delegate or direct any of that fund the IASB at this point. It can and does, of course, direct it to the FASB, and the FASB is more than well-funded by virtue of that. So if we're going to make progress through the SEC in funding, it is going to require that the SEC have discussions with the FAF in the direction of some kind of ongoing voluntary funding contribution. And we very much hope and have encouraged the SEC to undertake those discussions. We will wait to see what comes of those. So that is essentially the state of affairs on adoption and on funding in the U.S. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you all. Michelle.
Paul, just a couple of items I would like to mention before concluding. Firstly, I would like to mention the fact that we had a discussion in July in Johannesburg with regard to emerging markets and the way the IFRS address the issue of emerging markets. And the conclusion was clearly that today we consider that emerging markets are part of the organization and that they are fully and should be fully integrated in the standard setting system, in the education initiatives, and so on and so forth. There remain a specific effort, as you know, with regard to the IASB's Emerging Economies Group to address a few issues through a specific forum. But we do consider that today, be it the technical dialogue, the education initiative, or adoption support or representation, we consider that emerging markets are fully integrated in the organization and part of the organization. The second thing I would like to address is that in the meeting we will have in Frankfurt, we will look into your own homework, if I may say so, and we've been informed of the exercise you the Advisory Council led to look into its own functioning, and we have welcomed and supported this excellent initiative, and we will look into the conclusion and see how we can on our side improve where needed our relationship, which leads me to the last, very last item, really, which is you, Paul, and the 19 members that are about to leave this organization. I would like to express our gratitude to all of you. I will specifically mention Paul in Frankfurt. In accounting terms, this is a huge loss. The question is, how can you measure it? And I don't think any of the measurement systems we usually look into could give a clear approach of the loss of value. Amortized cost is obviously not applicable. Fair value is not applicable either, because there is no market for such an extraordinary personality. Modeled, I would not advise, because according to the inputs you would have, the value would be invaluable. So I'll stop there and say, Paul, thanks for your contribution to this organization. But this organization is a going concern. And as Bob said, we will have to continue and find a successor who will struggle to equalize the extraordinary chairmanship you have delivered, and that was, if I understand well, recognized by this body in the report that has been issued recently. Thank you very much. We're ready to...
Thank you very much for those very kind words, Michelle. And collectively, it is a large hole to fill, but it is also a huge opportunity. And I agree absolutely that the view going forward is the positives outweigh the negatives. We'll be dealing more with this at dinner, so don't think you're finished in terms of the farewell. But we've covered a number of very important aspects. We have some time, and I want to take advantage of it if members have any comments or questions based on what you've heard from Michelle, Scott, or Bob, or in general. Charles?
Thank you, Paul. Michelle, two comments, one related to funding and one related to international strategy. With funding, having been involved one way or another with IFRS for more than 10 years, I have long held a view which in a sense becomes stronger as I see the challenges that that the Foundation is facing, which is based on the observation that in all of those jurisdictions that either mandatorily adopt or permit adoption of IFRS, without exception, that requirement always applies to listed companies. Now, in some jurisdictions, it may be much broader than that, but without exception, it applies to listed companies. And, of course, they are the biggest beneficiaries of a free flow of international capital. So it seems to me that one of the easiest mechanisms for raising the necessary funding is to have what would be a very small levy on all listed companies in those jurisdictions where IFRS is either mandatorily required or is permitted. And because of the important role of IOSCO in terms of the regulatory oversight and the close relationship that the Foundation has with IOSCO, I would have thought that might be a fruitful line of pursuing dealing with the funding issue. The second observation relates to international strategy, and before you joined us at the morning tea break, I did make a comment in the earlier session, which is that next year Australia is hosting a G20 meeting, and they've set up a business or B20 group to present a business manifesto effectively to the government leaders there. And unlike the approach that was adopted by the Russian delegation this year, where there was a long shopping list of recommendations, far too many to be meaningfully considered, the approach that Australia is taking, and I'm privy to this because the head of the B20 delegation is actually the CEO of one of the public companies that I'm a director of, and we periodically get a very high level update on their focus. The approach they're taking is to try and identify two or three or four, no more, issues that one way or another will facilitate an improvement in the free flow of trade, international trade, goods and services, and also the free flow of international capital, with the carrot being that some of those measures will enable much stronger economic growth, which is a challenge that all countries are facing. So I would encourage the Foundation and the Board, perhaps cooperating with the Financial Reporting Council in Australia, to consider whether there's some leverage that could be taken advantage of as part of that B20 initiative.
Yes, well, two excellent remarks, Charles. On the first one, I agree with you fundamentally. The question is that we do not have jurisdiction on listed companies. We have to go through the national authorities. And by the way, in a number of countries, the arrangements that have been publicly sponsored, to use the formula we recommend usually, are precisely based on a contribution by listed companies, either directly. It is the case in my own country, where there is a committee that organizes the repartition of the funding between organizations of listed companies, and or indirectly, I can mention Spain, where the exchange plays a central role in this. So the difficulty we have is to find the relevant dialogue with the authorities, having in mind the fact that we believe that it is their role to determine their system, And I do privilege, as you mentioned, relying on listed companies at least at that stage, and for probably many years. But we can't do it by ourselves only, and we have to support their efforts to determine the best solution according to their national specificities. With regard to the G20, obviously we are working very closely with our Australian colleagues and friends to see how we could use the opportunity of the Australian chairmanship to design the approach to future developments worldwide. Ian is very instrumental in this, and we will, by the way, have a board meeting in Australia next year in April, and we very much hope to find with our Australian colleagues the relevant wording to maintain the sense of direction and strategy at the level of the G20, which we obviously need to develop the organization.
See two cards up, Joel and then Jeff.
First, thanks, Bob, to you and the other trustees for keeping the dialogue open with the SEC. The question I have is really around the two avenues you mentioned for potential adoption of IFRS in the U.S. It wasn't clear to me whether you were talking about the trustees' views or whether this has actually been shared with the SEC commissioners, and if so, what their potential, what you sense their reaction is.
It has been shared with the SEC chair and separately with most all of the commissioners. It's hard to know. I mean, part of the problem with telling you the attitude of the SEC is the SEC has been undergoing a change of both leadership and two other members. And it's hard to know quite where their thinking is. I think they understand the issues of both the structures, and I think they understand ultimately that there has to be a timetable for adoption. We have presented this other notion as an interim step, as a fallback position, and I think there is some sympathy for that, some support for it. There is, as I said earlier, and I have to admit, some concern in parts of the SEC that this sponsors the notion of two gaps, to which I think the right answer is there already are multiple two gaps. This isn't going to make it much worse, and in fact, it's a very sensible step for some companies who are really asking for it to be permitted to report in the same language as their competitors around the world do. So I think we're making progress there, but it's very hard to take a read of the pulse of the SEC at this point because the chair is new and two other commissioners are new.
Jeff.
Thank you. Two questions. First, for Michelle, on the way out here, I was reading an article in Accountancy Age by Jeremy Wolf that was talking about what's going on in the European Parliament. And part of that story, they talk about that there's some issues being raised about the composition of both the IASB and EFRAG, with one concern being that investors are not represented fully. Is that really an issue that's being debated and what you see happening there? And my second question is for you, Scott. I strongly believe, and I think most do, that having a very thorough public due process is critically important to the credibility of the ISB as it is for the FASB and any accounting standard setter. But one of my concerns when I was at the FASB and a concern for the ISB as well is at what point do you have too much due process so that it's difficult to bring a project to a conclusion in a high-quality manner? And how close are you to getting there, and what plans or processes or procedures do you have to prevent the ISB from having too much due process? Thank you.
On the first question, I'm not sure the members of Parliament who made the few amendments to the proposals by the Commission focused mainly on the issue of the composition of the board. They were more, and the professional press mentioned it, they were more focused on the way Europe could influence the process and European, in bracket, interests could be taken in consideration, having in mind the possibility to review the output of the organization and see whether the funding is properly used, which obviously is something we cannot consider as a positive approach, because we cannot imagine that all countries around the globe, all regions around the globe would look into the technical standard setting process with the possibility to use the funding as a sort of bargaining power tool. So this was more the kind of tone that was present in a few of the amendments. Some of them have been withdrawn, and we know that now takes place a trialogue between the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament, and we're trying to advocate in a way which will be acceptable to everybody. I'm hopeful that we will be successful. The issue of the representation of users might be raised within the review of the system as it is today, but it's too early to have a view on that. We're waiting for the final report by Philippe Maystadt, and it's always a difficult balance to find, to have representation of the professionals, the preparers, the users, the investors, and so on and so forth. So this is clearly a key point for the redesigning of the system which will be proposed by Philippe Maystadt. And then there will be discussions. It's probably too early to develop on this. I don't know whether Françoise would have something to say, but I think at that stage it's probably premature.
Sure. Jeff, the question of too much due process. I think it's a good question. And if I could restate it slightly, I think we want to make sure that in our efforts to have broad consultation, in our efforts to have maximum transparency, that we don't erect a bureaucracy that keeps standards from happening in a timely manner. And we're very focused on that. When we put the standards in place, we were very careful not to try to superimpose, another layer of bureaucracy. In many cases, we use the documents that the ISB itself uses as it goes through the process of bringing a standard to fruition. We're constantly asking the question to the ISB, to the ISB staff, to the consultative groups and other interest groups, whether or not the due process is becoming overbearing at any point in time. We do not want this to become a wooden check-the-box exercise. Then it loses its purpose. What we've got to do is make sure that there is vigorous consultation and good discussions happening, and that no one is left who should have a voice is left without a voice in the process.
Michelle, did you want to come in?
Yes, just a compliment on the on Jeff's question. Another set of issues that have been raised by a few members of Parliament were sort of debates on very high level principles that can, as I mentioned earlier, lead us in sort of impossible disputes on interpretation of very abstract concepts. you know, the issue of prudence, true and fair view, that sort of thing, which obviously Hans and his board struggle with, and I will not step in that field. What I just would like to mention is that I was really, as a person who shouldn't be involved in technicalities, I was really impressed by the quality of the conceptual framework paper that was issued early summer, and that is put for comment until January, because I think that when you read this paper, and I did it, it's 180 something pages, something like that. It's not exactly the kind of thriller you take on the beach, but I did read it, and partly on the beach, and I hope that many people who have, either for candid reasons or sometimes for tactical reasons, questions with this kind of high-level principles, will find relevant answers there. And I think this is extremely important for the future of the discussion.
Thanks, Michelle. I see two cards remaining. First, Joanne, and then Jim, and then I think we'll try to wrap up.
Just one particular comment. When you were talking about the role of the IFRS and the trustees, particularly with the emerging markets, I agree with you entirely that the emerging markets need to be involved. And you were talking in particular about, particularly in the technical dialogue, this involvement of the emerging markets is somewhat problematic in that many of them might not have a longevity in standard setting or a deep knowledge in standard setting. Typically, a Ministry of Finance would have determined the standard, and that's the standard you'll be applying. So that might be a difficulty. I think there are two ways you might consider going. The OECD is a standard setter, and as you know, it is not every country in the world is a member of the OECD, yet they set the standards for the conventions that every country must, not every country that's a member must adopt, but they have other adoptions occurring there. I think of the Anti-Corruption and Anti-Bribery and Corruption Convention. So they've done it largely through an outreach program, which was partially trying to get their principles and their rules and their standards in place in these countries, but also partly educative. I think there is another opportunity which you might actually be thinking about already, but just to raise it to your attention. The ASEAN countries are moving to one capital market, a very similar market as you have in the EU. And it might be an opportunity there for some involvement of those emerging countries in your strategy.
Yes, I wouldn't like to be misunderstood. It is clear that emerging markets and developing countries are extremely important to us, and that we are willing to devote efforts to deal with their specificities where needed. What I wanted to mention is the fact that they are so important and they are so integrated in our strategy that they are, as far as possible, part of the functioning of the organization, which doesn't mean that there are no possibilities to address specifically specific issues of education, training, or whatever. But in a way, if I may raise a parallel, which is not always a good approach, when you look at IOSCO, which I know well, there was, when I was a member of IOSCO, there was a divide between the technical committee, which I happened to chair, and Hans, and, where we had mainly the so-called advanced economy, and the emerging markets committee. And now IOSCO has a board. Doesn't mean that there is no emerging markets committee. There is a board. And the emerging markets are part of the board. So we are in a similar mood, if I may say so, which means that and ASAF is another good example. We had a dialogue with the US, we had a dialogue with the EU, we had a dialogue with Japan. Now we have a dialogue with the globe. And that was the meaning of my remark. It doesn't preclude specific groupings, working groups, devices to address specifically the issues of some emerging markets or some developing countries.
Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the trustees for the very informative comments you all made. My comment is brief and really is a follow-up to Jeff's question to Scott and Scott's response about due process overload. I live with this all my day job as well, so I understand the question and I understand the challenges. And I think, in fact, I was thinking about the IOSCO protocol that was mentioned earlier, which in effect becomes another piece of due process that the IASB will undertake, because it will consider and consult more broadly with IOSCO. But I would suggest that we have to be very careful that that's not the end. Once that consultation has happened and taken place, the board and the due process has to be able to inform all of the other interested stakeholders what was the context of that discussion and what is the outcome. So in fact, you're building on more due process with, I think, more due process in the interests of full transparency and informing the whole world and all interested parties. So I sympathize with your challenge.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we've covered a lot of territory there. Michelle, I guess in particular what resonated with me was the need to sort of reflect on strategy and vision in light of significant events in recent years, including but not limited to, I think, the financial crisis. It has altered the lie of the land. Or, if it hasn't, there needs to be a clear demonstration of that conclusion. I think we draw comfort from too much of a good thing can turn into a problem. And so I think that's encouraging that there's a sensitivity to not overtooling the due process oversight, but on the other hand, everyone acknowledging the extreme importance that it be done well, and that people see that it's being done. Bob's remarks dealing with the U.S., I think, are encouraging in the sense, and I should have pointed out at the beginning, Paul Beswick has chosen to be the SEC observer. He would be here today. He is collateral damage on the fund. I should have bought a prepaid ticket, I guess, but there you go. But absolutely engaged in this. And if I could reflect on my personal experience, having started on the international scene back in 1987, and indeed through that was when the technical committee was formed. And I keep reminding people time and time again when they start worrying about the U.S., you say, if someone would sit down and count the hours, the SEC was a major player right from the outset. It wasn't just accounting standards, it was auditing standards, it was multinational offering documents, it was listing requirements, it was enforcement. And to my knowledge, they have been continuously engaged, if anything, more so rather than less so up to today. Now, they're not the only player, but in my mind, that signals a huge commitment to the end game. Getting there, like Japan, like others, is sometimes difficult. I also find it interesting that we're sort of coming back. Your plan B or your fallback isn't all that dissimilar to what the starting point was when I first got involved, which was, well, why don't we start with eligibility criteria? You know, I think we were calling it world-class issuers at the time, but I think you've captured the essence of it. So it's encouraging, I think. And the message I would take away is on the communications front. I think we all have to keep reinforcing what's going on in various parts of the world. and to keep the pressure on, I think, is the long and short of it. So thank you very much to the trustees. It's terrific to have you with us and have an exchange of views. I hope you found it helpful. We certainly have.